this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 9th, 2011, and this is show number 294. Man, we're getting close to 300. Oh, the pressure to come up with something new every time we hit one of these major milestones is terrible. I have no ideas yet. Oh, well, you might have noticed that Connor P. really enjoys nitpicking me for mistakes I make in the show, and luckily that happens often enough that it does come up from time to time. But last week he did not catch me on one till I pointed it out. If you listen very carefully, you'll notice that I actually forgot to say the year last week when I started the show. I don't know, maybe it was denial about the new year, or perhaps the special beer I'd chosen, or perhaps it was the sheer excitement of having Justin Byrne of the Mac Crack in the room. But I deeply apologize for the omission. Before we dig in here, I did want to remind you to sign up for the NoSilla Castaways party. It's going to be at Macworld on Friday night, the 28th, at Jillian's from 6 to 8 p.m. Be sure to use the link on the right side of podfeet.com to register if you can come. Now, I've told you guys a bunch of times how much fun it is to watch the live show and how cool the NoSilla Castaways are, right? Well, when we were up in Fresno for Christmas, Steve's sister Linda happened to mention the live show. Totally out of the blue, she says, "You know, I need to get back in the live show again. It was really fun. You know what was weird? They were so nice to me. They were actually talking to me." Anyway, I loved her saying that because, you know, a normal human wouldn't expect a group of strangers to be all nice and kind and welcoming and all that. But we kind of take it for granted around here, don't we? If you haven't come into the live show before, try to make time to stop by at 5 p.m. Pacific time on a Sunday night. Even if you can't stay a long time, just stop by podfeet.com/live and say hi and you'll know what Linda was talking about. Well, I'm very excited to tell you about an enhancement to your NoSillaCast experience. You can now sign up for the NoSillaCast newsletter, which I am affectionately going to refer to as the NoSillaCast News. Hey, wait a minute. What problem does this solve? Well, let's use Mr. Peabody and Sherman's Wayback Machine to illustrate how useful the NoSillaCast News would have been. About 4 years ago, my hosting company went belly up. Out of the blue, podfeet.com would not return a ping. I mean, it was gone. Calls to my web host, and I am not making this up, were an answering machine with a little kid's voice saying, "We can't come to the phone right now because Mommy and Daddy are busy." It was unbelievable. The cold feeling down my spine was absolutely horrible. What was even more horrible was that I couldn't tell the listeners of that day and time that I hadn't quit, that I wasn't a deadbeat. I didn't just fall off the planet. It was awful. I was desperate. I was panicked. If I'd had people subscribe to the NoSillaCast News, I could have told them calmly that we were experiencing technical difficulties and to please stand by for further instructions. That would have given me peace of mind, at least, while I struggled with how to dig out of that situation. Now, just as a historical note, it was during that time that Bart and I became close friends. He helped me over a Thanksgiving week to transfer my entire site from my old ISP to GoDaddy. He spent probably 20 hours on Skype with me getting that done. I still wonder what he gets out of this relationship, you know? It seems like I take and he gives, but I don't know, for some reason it makes him happy. All right, let's not question it. Another problem that the NoSillaCast News would solve is when I goof up the podcast feed. Now, it doesn't really happen all that often, but it does happen. Here's the scenario. I upload a file to Libsyn, who hosts my audio files, and then I test the link. And then either Steve or I discover something wrong in the audio file. As fast as my fingers can fly, I fix the problem and I re-upload the file. The problem is that in that brief interval, maybe like a half hour, invariably some people have downloaded the bad file. All I can do is sit back and wait for people to write to me and tell them to delete the feed and resubscribe. I would love to be able to send out a preemptive strike email telling people that if they have a problem, here's how to fix it. Now, there's a third problem that the NoSillaCast News solves, and that's notification that the show and the blog is up online. Now, not everyone is a Connor P. who pings me pretty much from 8:30 on at night asking, "Is it up yet? Is it up yet?" I'm telling you, even on the Christmas week, when I came out with the show 2 days early, he's pinging me going, come on, is it up yet? Is it up yet? With a subscription to the NoSillaCast News, you'll know the instant I hit the publish button. Oh, Connor, I should mention that after I hit the blog publish button, and that's when the news article is going to go out, then I have to copy the article link into Feeder, so there is about a 30-second lag for the podcast itself. Now, since I'm so consistent with my blog and podcast postings being every single Sunday night, the last advantage of the newsletter isn't quite as huge. But imagine a normal blogger who's all over the map on when they blog. For those readers who just really haven't taken up on RSS, it would be great if they had an email notification telling them a new blog post is up. I love having this for my daughter's blog. You'll get that automatically with the No Cellacast news, but again, my anal retentive level of consistency makes this a little bit less of a benefit. And finally, there are occasions when I do something interesting on the blog that's not on a schedule. I know, it's crazy, isn't it? Like, say, a video interview like the one I did with Rod Roddenberry out at Catalina Island, for example. You know, it'd be fun to just let you know there's something to go enjoy. So if you'd like to subscribe to the No Cellacast News, just fill out the little form in the right sidebar on podfeed.com and you'll be in like Flint. Oh, and it's easy to unsubscribe if you decide you don't like it later on. Drop me a line and let me know what you think about the No Cellacast News. Well, as Bart would say, I'm rather chuffed this week by two mentions online. First, my podcast was mentioned in some very good company on the LA Times Framework blog by good friend of the show, Robert Lockman. In theory, he's trying to pick his top tech product of 2010, but in his own ADD kind of way, he mentions the Mac Geek Gab, Typical Mac User, the Mac Review Cast, and the No Cellacast. Check it out for a very fun read over at framework.latimes.com. The second mention I got was a plug for my Podcasting on Podcasting series. Over at imake.libsyn.com, an unnamed author wrote a podcast starter kit for absolute newbies. They describe a ton of online resources for how to start your own podcast, and they included some lovely words about podcasting on podcasting. As I said, I'm pretty chuffed about it. Hope you don't mind my bragging to you about it. Every so often, I like to mention backups. Not so often that it becomes noise to you, but enough to tickle your brain, you know, so you think, oh yeah, I really should make sure those are still running, or oh yeah, I've been meaning to do that. You know what? Today's the day I'm going to get her done. Well, this week I happened to listen to Adam Christensen's December 29th episode of the MacCast, which I really recommend. He had a science fiction author, J.C. Hutchins, on, who talked about how his iMac's hard drive died on him over the holidays. He woke up on the 24th of December to hear that tick, 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 tick of a hard drive failing. Anyway, this episode of the MacCast is a great episode for so many reasons. First of all, JC is an author, right? So he has this fabulous turn of a phrase, and he creates these great visual images in your head of the feelings and events that unfurled as this disaster struck him. Secondly, if you need the most vivid story of what it feels like to lose 10 years worth of data, you really got to get started with doing backups after listening to this. This is the story you need. I was riveted as I listened to JC describe the knowledge that his hard drive was gone as being like standing in a smoking crater where his life used to be. Oh, can you imagine? Anyway, go check it out over at maccast.com. Donald Stein sent in a completely unsolicited email that I just have to read to you. It's all about screen steps. I did not ask him to send this, but he sent it in, so I get to read it. Donald starts right in with, I love it. I live on Kelly's Island, a small island in Lake Erie, Ohio. We have about 150 year-round residents. In the summer, it grows to several thousand. I am the resident geek for the island, and I've been helping folks for the last 15 years, mostly Windows, and then he puts in like a little swear mark, but I use Mac, Windows, and Ubuntu. I've been listening to your podcast for many years. Every time I heard you talk about screen steps, I said to myself, I should get a copy of that program. Well, I did. I downloaded the trial, I made two lessons, and I emailed them to several friends who needed help. I told them I was using a trial version of Screen Steps because the trial version was pasted on each step. I told them I was going to buy the full version as soon as I gathered the funds. I mentioned that if the Screen Steps lesson helped, I would cheerfully accept donations through PayPal. Guess what? Two folks did donate a small amount, and I was able to purchase the standard version. Now I want to upgrade to the pro version. I'm now up to 12 lessons, all the way from showing how to check your version of Firefox to shutting off the water and winterizing a house. I take digital photos and I import them into Screen Steps. I now use an app called GoodReader to transfer the exported Screen Steps lessons as PDF to my new Christmas present, an iPad. I now have all of my Screen Steps lessons on my iBook shelf. Thanks so much for your podcast and Screen Steps. To repeat, I love it. Wow, Donald, that is quite a testimonial. I love that you help people and that they really liked your lessons so much that they helped fund the purchase of Screen Steps. I mean, it's not that much money, so it's pretty easy to get a couple of donations and be able to afford it. That really does say something, though, for what a good job you did on those lessons, and you had to have understood what problems they needed to have solved. Sounds like you're a fantastic resource to the island. I'm really glad that Screen Steps was able to help you out. To everyone else listening, if you'd like to be as helpful as Donald is to his friends, head on over to screensteps.com and give the free trial a shot. Don't forget to use my coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, for 25% off the purchase price of Screen Steps Desktop Standard or Pro. Well, I don't think we talked enough about backups. As I listened to the MacCast, I realized that all of my attempts to back up Steve's computer have failed, and that it was time to get back into it yet again and figure it out once and for all. Get her done. Now, you see, for most normal people, Time Machine is a fantastic alternative. It runs in the background while you're working away. It does an hourly incremental backup. It keeps versions of your material as you change it, so you can go back and retrieve a document. Say if you accidentally deleted it or you accidentally changed it. You've got versions going back. That's fantastic for normal people. But Steve isn't normal people. He's special. The reason he's special is because he works on giant video files for our home movies. He takes high-def video in AVCHD format, brings it into Final Cut Express, and then he exports .mov files, then burns them to DVD and now high-def DVDs using his new Blu-ray burner as recommended by Donald Burr. Now, imagine as he's working away editing a 3-gigabyte file, Time Machine starts keeping an hourly incremental backup of all those files. Well, in just a few days, that backup disk would be completely full. I can't even use it myself because I create the small audio files compared to what he creates, but it's just completely impractical for that. So over the years, I've tried lots of alternatives. Like I used a MacStore OneTouch backup drive. That's where if you want to run a backup, you simply push a button on the front of the drive and it copies over any change files, overwriting the old files. And it also runs an automated backup script in the background. I use this on my PC at work, and it works like a champ. It's awesome. Don't have a lot of control with the version I bought on what you back up, so there's some things that it isn't backing up that I want it to. But for my regular data files, man, they're all there and covered at all times. So I did buy that drive for Steve's Mac, but I don't understand quite what went wrong. I ran that automated backup script once, and it did work the first time, but it would never run a second time. The other thing I didn't understand was I wasn't able to actually reformat the drive to use it with, say, SuperDuper. So I wasn't sure what was going on there. So I bought him another external drive, and I tried to run SuperDuper for him on it, running an automated backups, but the disk I bought, it kept making little clicking noise. It got on his nerves. So I'd go in and say, how's your backups going? He'd go, oh, I turned that backup drive off. Okay. All right. That's good. So like I said, I tried SuperDuper on the Mac store. I tried SuperDuper on the new drive, and I wasn't able to get that to work. See, the other thing is sometimes Steve turns off the drives because they have a habit of slowing down his machine when he tries to access other disks. And I can't blame him for this. I've seen it happen. It's really freaking annoying. For example, he goes to open a file on his internal drive, and he gets a spinning pizza wheel of death while OS X, spins up the external drive he wasn't even asking for. Now, I know when you do disk access, it always has to check and make sure everything's all ready for you in case you need it. But, to be honest, I do get that same behavior with my Mac Store disk at work. My mail will suddenly pause while it wakes up the darn backup drive. I'm sitting there going, well, wait a minute, I didn't even ask for the hard drive. Why are you doing that? I was just checking my mail. I did find a utility online that does keep the disk awake for Steve, so now at least he lets that one disk live, for now, unless it misbehaves again. All right, we've now gotten ourselves up to this week where he's got no backups running at all by now. With all this effort, I mean, it's not like I haven't tried, but it's been hard, and I don't want it to be hard. Backups have to be easy, or you're not going to do them. So we sat down again this weekend to try and develop an automated yet practical backup strategy. For the first time, we actually characterized the data types. In the past, we'd kind of only characterized where the data lived. I'm going through this, by the way, in hopes that if you've tried to back up and you got stuck on one bit or another, this will help you slog through it to get to success. So anyway, Steve has three kinds of data, or four kinds of data, I guess. Small data files that change often, you know, spreadsheets, text documents, that kind of stuff. Second category is operating system and application files. The third category is large data files that don't change. These are the final output files of his projects. He makes more of them, but once he creates one, he doesn't change that one. Those are like the MOV files that get later on turned into the two-hour DVDs that he makes. The fourth category is the really tough category, large data files that are changing, like his Final Cut Express files and his iMovie iDVD files. Those are the ones that are just, they drive you around the bend. So once we had his data characterized, it was obvious how to attack the backup problem, and it wasn't with one solution, it was with two. The small data files that change often and the OS application files are the perfect data set for Time Machine. We hooked up that pesky Maxdor drive that was so recalcitrant about being reformatted by SuperDuper, and we told Time Machine to beat it into submission. In about 30 seconds, Time Machine had reformatted and renamed the drive. Nothing to it. I don't quite know why I was having trouble before. Actually, now that I think about it, I was trying to use Disk Utility to rename it, and I had a terrible time. Something was wrong. Anyway, so now he's got this reformatted drive. It says Time Machine Backup on it. We went into the options, and we excluded Steve's giant movies directory. That left a mere 200 gigabytes of files to be backed up onto the 750 gigabyte Maxdor. Now, by the way, Adam and others recommend your backup drive be at least double your data size to use Time Machine effectively, so this was perfect. We told her to run the backup, and it immediately set to work. And throughout this weekend, it's been doing hourly incremental backups, and Steve is really happy about that. Okay, next, we have to tackle the big data that doesn't change very often. For that, Steve went out and bought a 2 terabyte external Western Digital MyBook and set up SuperDuper to run backups. SuperDuper is available from shirt-pocket.com. Now, sadly, we still can't practically keep all of his video source material. For example, a single two-hour DVD's worth of source material was 70 gigabytes, and he makes a lot of these videos. The good news is that a very high-resolution .mov version is around, I want to say, like 3 to 5 gigabytes, so he can keep that. It wouldn't give him all of the ability to edit the movie easily later, but if there's a new format comes out, you know, that's beyond Blu-ray and it's way cool, he's going to be ready with that high-def version to convert to the next format. For this backup, he can have it run much more occasionally, maybe, you know, once a week or even only after he's completed something major. The downside here is you don't have versions of your files, but this kind of data doesn't really have versions. We did also create a small 150 gigabyte partition on the 2 terabyte drive, so he can use it as a scratch space to drag over a video project while it's in work. Now, I can hear Bart yelling at his iPod right now, asking, how many darn drives is Steve going to have littered all over his desk by the time you're done? Well, the answer's 4, till I add another one. I bought the cutest little Western Digital portable 500 gigabyte drive a while ago. Not because I needed it, but because it was adorable. It fits all nice in the palm of my hand. I may donate that to Steve's cause and let him use that as a place to drag work-in-progress files from Final Cut Express, so I'll have peace of mind if he doesn't find enough space on that other drive. I don't want him to worry and have all of his time wasted in the event of a hard drive failure. Okay, I'm thinking I need an omnigraphal diagram of this now, but at least Steve's getting backed up. Now, I can just hear you guys. What about offsite backup, Allison? Well, the most important thing on Steve's drives is the home movies, and they exist on his hard drives, backed up, on a set of DVDs in the house, on a backup drive in the house, on a drive connected to the Mac Mini, and a copy in the safe deposit box. Someday when I'm not so exhausted, I do have to figure out offsite backups of his small data files, though. That will wait for another day. Okay, I have one last thing about backups, and this one's a really happy story, too. My buddy Ron was over a couple of weeks ago, and he was messing around with Automator and AppleScript, and in a flippant and demanding moment, I seem to have those a lot, I said, hey, Ron, write me a script I can easily launch that will back up my feeder file. All right, backing up here, not backup, backing up, what's the problem to be solved? I have on-site and off-site bootable backups of my MacBook Pro, but I write my long, drawn-out blog post using Feeder all week long, I would hang myself if I lost that midweek between backups. So it's literally only backed up twice a week. I sometimes get around to using a little thumb drive, that kind of thing, but I don't do it very often. And once in a while, I'll drag a copy of my feeder file over to Dropbox when I think of it. But it means opening two Finder windows, drilling down to the right folder, and dragging into the right folder on Dropbox. I do it not nearly as often as I would like. So Ron started with some really complicated ideas to solve this problem. And like any developer who's really talented, he kept working on it until he was down to two really simple, easy steps in Automator. The steps are to tell Automator to get specified items from the Finder and then to copy those files to Dropbox to the exact location while replacing the files, or overwriting the last copy you put there. Well, duh, that sounds easy. Since it was so easy, I thought it might be helpful to write a little tutorial, using screen steps, of course, on how to create this script for yourself. I put a link in the show notes to the Automator tutorial, and it's also in the menu bar at podfeed.com under Tutorials. Just in case you're new to Automator, as I am, I made it really detailed, not skipping any steps so you can follow along. If you've always wanted to try your hand at Automator, this might be a fun 15-minute project for you to try out. In any case, thanks to Ron for a great script. I am now backing up my feeder file about five times a day now instead of a couple of times a week. My buddy John Zellner is a Unix system administrator, primarily specializing in managing Sun servers, but he's also got an amazing talent. John is an artist who draws the most curiously amazing creatures you've ever seen. I mean, you could never imagine how bizarre these things are. Some of his drawings are delightfully whimsy, some are slightly disturbing, and a few pretty much send a cold chill down your spine, like the picture he painted of his brother. Now, I've been a big fan of John's artwork over the years, and quite a while back, I scanned in a big pile of his drawings, and I created a terribly crude website for him. It was my first ever website, and it was awful, but he loved that he could show people what he'd created. That site eventually came down when MobileMe came into play, and until last weekend, I'd never recreated it for him, even though it was on that mental to-do list for literally years. Over the holidays, I finally got around to putting a new site up for him. Now, we have two problems to be solved. The first problem was to just get the artwork back online. The second problem is funding for a website. I knew without asking that money would be a problem, so I decided to create a WordPress site for him, but instead of making him pay for hosting and a domain name, I set him up on the free WordPress.com. Now, this introduces a fair amount of restrictions. Now, I'm not saying any complaints here. You know, it's just a good info to keep in mind. It's free, and so they constrain you. Like, you don't have a vast choice of themes like you do on the outside, and you can't install your own plugins. They do have a fair amount of themes to choose from, and as I was able to find one that I thought fit the spirit of his artwork. I then had to figure out how to create an image gallery without a plugin, but I did finally crack the code on that. I haven't yet figured out how to add another image to the same gallery, so I'm not completely done figuring this out. Anyway, I spent a lot of time on it, and I'm really pleased with how well it came out. And best of all, John loves it. If you'd like to see John's amazing drawings, check it out at zamps.wordpress.com. That's zamps.wordpress.com. Well, I'm afraid yet another week has gone by without the need to see Honda Bob. I did get an email, though, from a friend asking whether I could talk Honda Bob into working on her Mini Cooper. She just needed her taillight assembly work done. I had to tell her sadly that Honda Bob is just what he says. He only works on cars from the Honda Motor Company, which luckily for me includes Acuras, but does not include Mini Coopers. I'm sure there are some fine mechanics around the LA area that could help her out, but one of the great luxuries of using Honda Bob for me is I've never had to do that search. We found Honda Bob in 1978. That is the last time I ever looked for a mechanic. Imagine that, one mechanic for 33 years. That's a real testament to the quality of his work, his honest dealings, and with how effortless it is to have him come to your house and work on your Hondas or Acuras. If you live in the LA or Orange County areas and you drive a Honda or an Acura, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And this week we are actually calling it Chit Chat Across the County because I have Victor Cahill of the Typical Mac User Podcast and the Typical Shutterbug Podcast on the line here. How are you doing today, Victor?
Hey, Allison. Great to be here. I guess we could have called it Chit Chat Across the Pond late December when it rained for 6 days in a row, right?
Yeah, that was a 40 days and 40 night kind of rain we had going on. It's confusing to walk outside and see sun now, so that's not the way it should be, that's for sure.
We're lucky here. I think we complain, but we're so lucky to have the weather we have.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I was at the gym. I'm not making this up. And this woman said, oh, God, is it still cold out there? And I said, it seemed fine to me. And she goes, man, when I came in, it was 49 degrees. Really? It's January. It's almost 50. You know, that's tough.
Yeah, we're really spoiled. I mean, I see this stuff on Twitter all the time, and I'm surprised we don't get slammed in the head more often when we complain about our weather. And I mean, you tend to just brag about it outright.
Yeah, I'm looking for a smackdown, right?
You are, yeah.
Sending pictures of me in flip-flops on Christmas Day, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I thought that was rather ironic. But you do it all the time, so I'm like, she's just trying to get people's goats.
Well, the first time it happened, it wasn't even on purpose. I was Steve took a picture of me or a video of me playing with my new orbital polisher on my car, and I think it was Bart who pointed out, you're wearing shorts and a tank top and you're barefoot. It's February where you are. And I didn't even think of it, right?
No, of course not. I mean, we get used to it, and, you know, it becomes nothing for us. But we forget, you know, those people in North Dakota, hey, Julie, who are freezing, you know. And so I know what that's like. Being married to a North Dakotan, she reminds me often of what winter really is when I complain.
Well, this isn't This Week in Weather. We should probably move on. I wanted to get you on the show because you have such a great depth of understanding of photography from, you know, the highest end photography kind of work that you do, but you have the ability to bring it down to normal people level and explain things. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit about what you've learned in photography from low to high end and maybe give us some pointers here.
Sure. I'm happy to do that. And really it was I restarted, if you will. I've taken pictures since I was a little kid in one form or another. But a couple of years ago, I came upon the fact that I wanted to get back into photography. And I didn't know a lot of stuff. I had forgotten so much, you know, about the basics. And I had never been disciplined about photography. So I said, I really want to learn this. And, you know, as podcasters, we want to learn something. We'll start a podcast about it because now we have a commitment.
You have to.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and to me, it was like, I want to learn through speaking with people who really know because I certainly don't know. So I started the Typical Shutterbug Podcast 2 years ago. I can't even believe it's been that long.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'm surprised.
And the premise was, I know nothing, but I want to learn this stuff and I want to learn it right. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to interview all these great authors, all these great photographers who really know stuff. And then I'm going to apply that, you know, day by day into my own photography. And lo and behold, that's what's happened. And I've gotten to learn a lot of stuff. So I just want to say right off the bat, I'm not a professional photographer. I'm just like all of you. I've just been listening to my own show and reading a lot of books and shooting all the time, which I think is the key to success in anything is practice, practice, practice.
That's what they say. It looks. I'm just checking out. You've had Robert Lockman, who is a professional photographer, on your podcast just this last week, right?
Yeah, he did a fantastic. I mean, you know, Robert had not been on in 2 years, and we were like, duh, because I go out shooting with Robert at least a couple of times a year, and he teaches me a bunch, and he's probably the most pragmatic photographer I've ever met. You know, I'd learned so much from his approach of keep it simple. And so we finally had him on, and we talked all about photojournalism and the formal side of that of him, and then we talked a lot about just his approach to photography, which has been a real lesson for me. And I think where it starts is really in the importance of the image itself. You know, I think we forget, and when we go out there shooting casually, that we can shoot casually for our family or vacation or whatever, but then we can maybe step it up a bit if we're really interested in photography and think about what we're going to shoot and why we're shooting it and the way it's going to look. And I think that has to be the foundation. If you really want to kind of step up your game, it certainly is not the equipment, although I know we'll talk about equipment today, Allison. Whatever camera you have today is fine in order to accomplish any photography. I know of a ton of photographers, professional and non, that do fantastic work, and it's not about the equipment. That's just the choice that you can make for yourself if you want to. So,
what is that line they always say? Nobody ever asked Ansel Adams what kind of camera was he using?
That's right. That's right. And it's not just Hamsel. I mean, there's so many examples out there of fantastic photography with camera, with mobile phones that we'll talk about. So I thought maybe we could talk about some different types of cameras and some of my thoughts around those. But I really wanted to lay the foundation that, you know, although we'll talk about the different types, that it's really about developing your eye and really getting out and practicing and seeing the world through a different point of view. And I think that's what it takes. And that takes practice. It can be learned. You don't have to be naturally talented. You can actually learn this stuff.
Okay, that's good to know. So where do you want to start?
Well, I think compact cameras are really a great way to start. I mean, first of all, we probably all have one right now. So if you do, you know, use that one and start with that. They're very portable, and that's really, really great. These days, even the least expensive ones, the, you know, $100, around $100 area, they can take great pictures for general use. Now, the difference is going to be really as far as when we go print our images, you know, we start getting into the higher-end cameras, more megapixels, you've heard that term. For most of us, I mean, it really is not going to matter because we're not going to be blowing up pictures to 11 by 13 in poster
size.
Or
maybe even printing in the first place.
Most people, as you probably know,
right.
And I'm guilty of it, we don't print. And my wife beats me up about this all the time. Why don't you print that great work that you're doing? Why just look at it in the net? And she's right. That is something that is getting easier to do as well. So, you know, the compact cameras, first of all, they can be with you all the time. And I highly encourage everyone who's interested in photography to have a camera in your glove compartment, in your person somewhere all the time, because you never know when you're going to get that moment that you're going to say, God, I wish I could take a picture of that. So one of the things you want to consider in this is size. You know, does it fit in your hand? You know, do you want to carry it in your pocket or your purse? Or, you know, are you okay with something a little bit bigger? I think you have to be comfortable with whatever it is with compact cameras. So it's important to do that. The other consideration, well, I think, is...
Let me interrupt you for a second. One of the things I worry about is the fact that everybody buys everything online because it's cheaper these days. But to me, being able to go to a real store and actually hold it in your hand and feel what it feels like, I chose my digital SLR based on what one felt right. Because I knew if it didn't feel right, I wasn't going to use it.
You're so right about that. And yeah, I encourage people to do that. And the camera stores, they're still out there, brick and mortars and the Best Buys. And they carry all the general brands that you're going to like, you know, so...
I paid extra to buy it at a local place so that I could support that and make sure that I could, you know, I could feel it.
Yeah, I think that's important. One of the considerations is this viewfinder, you know, something that we don't think about. I mean, I grew up, as probably you did, you know, the old Kodak cameras where we actually, you know, put our eye to that little piece of glass that wasn't doing anything except saying, you're kind of shooting over there. You know, it was like, you know, you were taking it was like a shotgun approach to photography. But now we have just such the cool ability to really see the picture in compact cameras. You know, the odd thing is that we do have to hold them up in front of us and look through that viewfinder. And that does a little bit distort, you know, the more normal thing of what your eye is seeing, because just think about it. Just the plane of sight of the camera is probably lower than what your eyes are. And so you have to kind of compensate for that. But the screen, being able to see the composition of that, what it's going to look like right there at the final moment is really important. They have the screens keep getting bigger, you know, really nice, super sharp 3-inch LCDs these days, or whatever type of technology they're using for all of that. But many of them do still have, you know, the old type of viewfinder, but less and less so these days. Mostly it's that screen.
Right. Now, what kind of, which way do you push people for batteries? I know a lot of people think, well, if I can have rechargeable batteries that I, or regular AA batteries, that's really handy. But then they have some limitations too, right?
They do, and I tend not to go to those types of cameras. I'd rather, you know, spend an extra $30 and buy an extra battery for the compact camera of my choice. You know, it is nice to have a removable battery, however. So if it's not going to be the regular AA type batteries, then try to find one that you can remove or buy an extra battery, because usually you're not going to use more than two in any one day, even if you're really going nuts. These things are very efficient.
Oh, they last forever nowadays. Yeah. Yeah. To go to a second one, I think you'd really have to go out of your way.
Yeah. I mean, that didn't used to be the case. I mean,
right.
when these first came out, it was like you had to walk around with AA's, and AA's was the way to go because of that. But this technology, just like our phones and everything else, they're getting so much out of batteries these days. It's just amazing. I applaud the engineers for that.
I know I took my my Nikon D40 to a cross-country meet, and I shot 435 photos in one meet, and it was down like a quarter of its ability, you know, of its charge.
Yeah, it is. And I guess what it's a NiCad or whatever they're using these days, they really extend the battery life. So that's something to consider. Another thing is, you know, whether on the compact camera itself, does the lens actually go out? You know, when you turn it on, does it actually come out of the camera? Or is it just always flat? And that is a difference in how the camera is going to be handled, or less moving parts for things to go wrong. That also has an impact on the size. So, you know, check all those things out. I really love your advice to go out and physically look at these things, although you can always get them online for a better deal. It's really important to see how it fits. I think that's really, really great advice. And then something that people don't think of a lot is, you know, does it have a wrist strap or not? You know, believe it or not, a lot of people, because they're in situations where, you know, you might be in a raft, or you might be in a place where having that wrist strap so you don't lose it might make the difference, you know, of you saying, oh my gosh, I lost all my pictures. And it's not about the camera. You can replace that. But if you've spent the whole day shooting, and because you set your camera down someplace, now you don't have it, man, you're going to really be in a world of hurt. And it's not about losing the camera again.
Right.
So compacts, I think, are great. I think everybody has one. Do you have a compact camera?
I do. I got to tell you, though, Victor, I don't think I've taken it out since I got the iPhone 4.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
that's we'll talk about right those there.
But try taking it out, because I think what they offer is some flexibility. For example, most of them have some kind of a zoom lens, optical usually.
True.
And, you know, 8x or 12x. And those lenses are very good in a lot of cases. They also have a very good ability to do macro photography. Most of them have these presets that are built, and one of them usually is macro. And you can take some stunning macro shots with compact cameras these days. Something that the iPhone, I don't think, does as well. So, you know, don't neglect that compact. Once in a while, you know, take it out with the purpose of taking photographs that you want to see. And
as opposed to just you ran into something cool you want to take a picture of, make a point of taking photos.
I think that that's kind of the beginning of our talk. And the reason that I want to talk to you guys about this is, yeah, have a purpose in mind. We're all going to take casual pictures, vacation pictures, you know, Macworld pictures. That's a different type of photography than what I said before, saying, you know, what am I shooting? What's the importance of that? Why am I shooting this image? What perspective do I want to give? You know, and I think a lot of the compositional parts of photography, that's what it comes down to, is not the norm, which is, you know, holding the camera straight out in front of our face and saying, that's what I want to take. But taking a moment to say, what would happen if I walk 40 feet in either direction from where I'm at now? What does that angle look like as opposed to my first reaction to taking, a landmark if you're doing landscape? What would it look like if I took it from down low? As a child would see a picture, you know, get on your knees and look at that perspective, or way up high, you know, shooting down. So I think that intent to take pictures, no matter what kind of camera, separates the beginning of photography with purpose rather than casual photography that we tend to do every day.
That's something I never think to do, Victor. And whenever I see the photos by people like Steve Stanger, it's like, what would make you think to do that? You know, I guess that's trying a lot of different views, and like you say, practicing.
It is about practice. Same thing with Bart. You know, Bart has a great eye for taking pictures from a unique perspective and for thinking about light, which is another huge clue to taking good pictures. Is what is the light doing? I mean, what are we doing? We are capturing light. That is the foundation of all photography. And so if you're going out to shoot with a purpose, you do have to think about the fact that the light is better, you know, between 5 a.m. and 8, and between, you know, 6 p.m. and a half to 45 minutes after the sun has actually gone down. Many people think that because the sun has gone down now and it's dark, that you have to stop shooting. No, that's where you get some of your most dramatic skies in the colors of blue and those reds. You can't see them because you're not seeing what the lens can fully see in its full range, but the camera sure can. So usually photography with purpose, and Mary will attest to this, means every vacation we get up early, you know, and I mean early, 4 a.m. We're out there shooting. And
notice
and
then, never been on one of your photo walks, Victor.
Right. But again, that's because you're going for something. Why? Just because that middle of the day sun is just too harsh. You know, the shadows that it throws are just – so it's having all those things in mind and saying, yeah, that's worth it to me to do something. I'm going to go take pictures of some flowers. You know, I'm going to carry a spray bottle with water with me.
Oh, you know, you cheat on that do thing?
Absolutely, you cheat. You cheat and you kill pixels with a vengeance. That's exactly what I think creating is about. You know, I'm not a photojournalist. I'm not here to tell the story of exactly how it was.
This is about art, right?
Well, I don't know about art. I wouldn't call myself an artist, but it's leaning towards art. And that,
so.
That includes post-processing, you know, and seeing something that I want to capture the feeling in the moment where I was at and what I want to convey. And if that means killing pixels in post-processing, I'm going to do that. And if that means carrying a water bottle and saying, wow, it's dry as a, you know, everything here in California, with a little mist, I can make that macro shot be out of the ordinary. So yeah, it's cheap. Cheat vigorously when you shoot the photos. Sorry, we got away from our compacts here.
No. This is fascinating, though. I like that.
So do you want me to recommend a couple of cameras in this area? And again, you guys, this is only from the little bit that I know. There are tons of great cameras. So let me recommend two that I have either used or owned. The first one I don't own, but I have used, and that's the Panasonic Lumix DMC T210. Of course, there'll be links in the show notes. And that's about $249. So it isn't the $100 camera or the $150, which you can get great ones of. But I think if you're going to go to this step and maybe have this be your only camera, you want to go ahead and spend a little bit more money to get good quality of lenses and flexibility. This particular camera is 12.1 megapixels. It has an incredibly good 12-time optical zoom. And what I mean by that is that it's the glass itself that is the optics itself. You'll hear digital zoom up to 50 times. Well, that's not good. You want the glass to provide those optics. And in this case, it's a Leica lens. So it's a really great lens. The equivalent of about 35 millimeter to 300 millimeter in a 35 millimeter camera. Sorry, that was 25 millimeter to 300. That's a huge range.
That's really big.
Yeah, this is a $250 camera, but it has complete manual mode. So if you want to get experimental and play with aperture, play with shutter, you can do that. This one also has GPS built in.
Wow. And I see from what you've written, it's an f3.3 to 4.9. So the 3.3, that's a pretty fast lens for a compact camera.
Right. And what we mean by a fast lens, you guys, is that when you are in a darker situation, it's going to open more, letting the camera be able to focus and give you less noise in your pictures, less little grainy dots in your picture. The lower that F number, then, you know, the more light can come into the camera without having to compensate with other things. Go listen to the show for those details.
Yeah.
Because it can get real deep. So this is a good camera. For the price, I think this was originally like $349. It's going for $249 at Amazon right now. So that's really good.
Cool.
Now, on the higher end, I'm going to recommend a Canon camera. And I own the equivalent of this called the Canon G11. But the Canon G11 is really a mid-size camera. It's not compact at all. But this one I'm going to recommend is, and this is the Canon PowerShot S95. Now, this camera will shoot in a RAW format, as opposed to some other cameras that we've talked about here that usually shoot in JPEG. That means it's already compressed and that you can't do quite as much in post-processing as you can with RAW. There could be entire shows and arguments based on this concept. Tons of photographers, including Robert Lachman, shoot in JPEG. Okay, so if that tells you something, but if you want to shoot in RAW, you want to experiment with being able to kill those pixels in the way you want the most, then RAW provides you that that range, that bandwidth where you can say, wow, I messed up. I remember when we went to San Francisco on Macworld, and I went out and shot some pictures at the Muir Woods. And I came back.
That was another one of those 4 a.m. ones I didn't join.
It was, yeah. And I came back, Allison, and every one of those pictures was blue.
Oh,
blue, blue,
no.
blue, blue, blue.
So your white balance was off?
Yep. Oh. I had set my white balance during, I went and shot the bridge and I had set it for something else and I didn't put it back. You know,
don't you think there ought to be a reset button on cameras? Yeah. There ought to be just a button that goes start over.
Yeah, there should be. Yeah, put it back. I guess there is. I mean, you can, but you have to remember, right?
But you have to do all of them, right?
It's all there if you remember.
Right.
So shooting raw meant that I could take every one of those shots in post-processing at one time and say, oops, no, find where the balance was on the first one, fix them all instantly, and I lost nothing. Because with raw,
it took me a long time to jump on the raw bandwagon. Bart was belly aching to me for just years about it, and I finally did it. And now I'm finally starting to get it. Is I'm starting to realize how much I can correct a photo and rescue something that otherwise I would have had to throw away.
Yep.
And not to do an ad for Aputure, but since Aputure is only $80 in the Mac App Store now, one of the cool things you can do with it, and you probably do this with Lightroom as well, is you can do a bunch of adjustments on a photo, like fixing the white balance, and then you can actually like pick up those settings and splat them onto a whole bunch of photos.
Yep.
So you can just fix them all at once. So if it's a white balance thing, you just go boom, and they're all fixed, and now you start to do your adjustments on each photo.
That's exactly what I did, and it saved me a ton of time and a lot of heartache because I had some good pictures in there.
Oh, that would have just broken your heart. Oh, you must have been killing yourself.
Yeah. So the S95, I'm telling you, it's the nearest thing to a DSLR without it being a DSLR that you're going to get. I think it's about $479 for this camera, but wait, there's more. I mean, this thing has – you can fully go manual. It has aperture priority, just like a DSLR. Shutter priority, just like a DSLR. You can change the ISO from anywhere from 80 to 1600.
Jeez.
So you can really go manual with this camera and do as much experimentation as you want. And then it shoots in 720p video as well, and it does a good job of that. And so it's a really great investment if you say, you know, I'm never going to get in the DSLR thing, but I really want to take really good pictures that are going to hold up. Absolutely. You take this as a camera and you can be done. You can say, that's as far as I ever want to go. And you'll take pictures that are every bit as good of any picture that I can take with the D700, really.
Oh, it's got an f2.0 lens, which is really good for low light. And they put it for shallow depth of field. So, yeah, you could have a lot of fun with this.
Yeah, and it has a mode where if you know there is high dynamic range photography, HDR, this will actually do bracketing. So you can tell it, okay, I want to shoot three pictures, and it'll shoot them all at different apertures so that you can come back and then, you know, process them in as an HDR photo.
Wow.
So really, really powerful, and it's tiny. This camera is tiny versus my G11. It has the same sensor and everything.
But so that's something you would have with you, which makes the difference, right? It doesn't matter how good your other camera is if you're not going to carry it. Wow.
Yep. The only difference between this and the G11 is that the G11 has more of the knobs accessible quickly so that you can very quickly do something through there rather than menu-driven settings. But that's it. That's a trade-off. You know, and many times, I even though I have the G11, I'm like, gosh, the other one would be much smaller. I would probably carry it more with me if I had it. So.
Right.
So there you go. So there's some stuff about compact cameras. And then
cool.
I think what's next is mobile phones, right?
Oh, yeah. Those are everywhere now.
They are. And, what can we say about these things? They've gotten so good. You know, they're with us almost 100% of the time. No matter what mobile phone you carry today, whether it's a smartphone or just a phone that has a camera, you have the perfect opportunity to practice your craft and to practice going out and learning how to shoot. There is no excuse, you know. And they can be used for little simple things, like when I go to the baseball game, I always forget where I'm parked. So I shoot the parking lane of where I'm parked.
I'm going to put a picture in the show notes of where we parked at Disneyland because I do that exact same thing.
Yeah.
Or what the view looks like coming out of where you are, because we always memorize what it looks like going in, but that doesn't do you any good when you're trying to figure out when you come out.
Good one. And then with the iPhone, of course, we have GPS. It could actually take us back there if you wanted it to. Right?
So now that's really using it.
Yeah, so that's really cool. You can document where you've been as opposed to just meeting someone. You can say, hey, meet me right here, you know, and you can actually send them a photo. You can SMS a photo of where you're going to meet rather than kind of take a guess. You're in a mall. Well, where am I at? Well, this is where I'm at. This is what it comes like. And these things, what, come from 2 megapixel to about 8 megapixels. I know some of the ones that are out there have 8 megapixels. And you can, you know, we're not going to get the same quality as an SLR, but boy, it's really handy to have that with you all the time. And these days, as you know, Allison, with the iPhone, you know, you can get some fantastic shots. I have Robert Lachman, coming back to Robert. He has some of the very best iPhone photos I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. Photographyinthemac.com, by the way. If you guys haven't been there, just go scan those photos. And that's where you tell it's the photographer, not the camera.
Exactly. And Robert does a great job. And if you look at his pictures, look at his composition. He's applying the same exact principles as he would as a photojournalist or using a $5,000 SLR. And his pictures are unique because of that. And then he does some post-processing, very little. You know, he'll use one of the phone apps that come with our iPhones, or he'll take it, I believe, into one of the Adobe products and just do very little post-processing, dodging and burning, you know, which means darkening certain areas or lightening certain areas, just little tiny things that then make those things pop a little bit more, a little more sharpening. But I think when it comes to mobile cameras these days, it's a pretty short discussion. Use whatever you have, and if you can afford it, you know, pick up one of the iPhone or one of the Droids that has a good camera, and it'll step up your game. Like you said, Allison, barely having the need to carry a compact if you don't want to do that.
The thing I like most with the iPhone 4 camera is taking pictures of the sky. It just, it does something. I don't know what it is, but the sky photos are always amazing on the iPhone 4.
Yeah, and with a new HDR feature, which works really well. For being an in-camera, you can really take some stunning pictures. And of course, I mean, we could spend a whole show talking about camera apps that give you anything from an old world look like some of the 70s cameras to being able to do some great panorama shots, you know, which the iPhone does so well. Do you use that kind of application a lot in yours?
On occasion. I've got an app called Pano that I like to do panoramas with, but it's more... I don't know. I don't think I've ever come out with anything that I went, wow, that's fantastic. My son does. My son's got a pretty good eye. Kyle takes some interesting photos he did up in San Francisco where he got the whole bay and that sort of thing. To me, it's more of a party trick game that I enjoy doing it, but nothing that I've just said, wow, that's a photo I'm going to keep.
Yeah, so since this show is about Macs, too, with an ever so slight leaning towards Mac, let me tell you about a few of the photo apps that I have on my iPhone, okay?
Okay.
Because maybe some people... Now, one I use for panels is called Auto Stitch, and it is wonderful. It is like, I highly recommend that. The big tip to taking panels with your iPhone is do not hold the phone horizontally.
Really?
Vertically, yeah. And that's either with your iPhone or with your DSLR. If you're going to take panoramas, put the camera in a vertical, not horizontal position, because you're going to you're filling up more of the frame. You may have to take a few extra shots, but you know how you usually have to cut off the pictures a lot in top and the bottom.
And real skinny and long.
Right. This way, you have more room in the sky and in the bottom to be able to do that cropping. You'll do less cropping. So a couple of more pictures that you can take. But you'll do less cropping doing that. So Auto Stitch, if you don't have it, highly recommend it.
Now, here's another trick somebody taught me that one of the problems I'll have is I'm taking a bunch of pictures of some great view, and then I say, oh, now I'm going to do a panorama. And then when I get all the photos, I'm sitting there going, why do I have so many photos that look so similar? And I can't remember where I started the pano and ended it. So somebody said, take a picture of your hand with your palm facing you, and then take all your panorama pictures, and then take a picture of the back of your hand. And it brackets that set of photos so that when you get into Aperture or whatever, you go, oh, that's a panorama I'm doing right there.
Yeah, I do that with HDR all the time.
Two
fingers before the HDR set and three after so that I'll know where it started. So yeah, same concept.
Oh, cool.
Very, very cool. Photogene. Photogene is a great in iPhone editor. I use it all the time to take pictures.
Is that G-E-N-E?
Yeah, it's one word, photo, G-E-N-E. Huh. And this thing is like a little mini Adobe Photoshop right in your iPhone. You can change exposure levels. You can change some of the white balance stuff. You can crop. You can straighten. Hmm. You can put some special effects. And then you can either send those out to Twitter or whatever or just put them right back into your film roll. No, really, really recommend this.
I've been using PS Express for that, which is Photoshop Express.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it does exposure. It'll do crop and straighten and special effects, and you can add some color things. A little on the gimmicky side in the color things, though.
Yeah, no.
I have to check out Photogene.
Photogene is just excellent. I mean, you can do sharpening with it. You can add some borders with it. I mean, it has just the full thing. All cropping, all straightening.
For $2.
Yeah, sharpening. You can change your levels. So you know the curves like you normally do.
Oh, you're kidding me. Oh, I'm totally downloading this.
Yeah, and you can do it auto or not. You can change exposures. You can change your colors. So if you want more saturation or your color temperature, you can change that. And then you can change RGB. You can put call-outs, like little bubbles, and you can type into the little bubbles if you want to point something out to somebody, like a cartoon type of thing. So, yeah, $2. I mean,
I need that.
Yeah, cannot go wrong. And then I'll throw one more. I have like 20 of them, but one more. This one is called Magic Hour. We talked about getting up early and late. Well, one of the things you want to know as a photographer is exactly where the sun is going to be at all times. Magic Hour tells you, when the sun is going to rise and set tomorrow or any day of the year, and exactly where the sun is going to be or when the moon is going to be. And it's going to give you the difference between, what is the civil, nautical, and astronomical dawn and dusk, and when are those going to happen? That's even too geeky for me. But this really is neat. If you're like when I was in Glacier National Park, we used this, and I knew right where the sun was going to be rising from, so I could actually drive to a point where I would get, the sun doing what I wanted it to do, basically. So any application like this, there's a couple of them. Focal Wear is one. And Magic Hour is another, good investments and all those. So there we go. Bunch of phone stuff. Sorry, cool. It's iPhone centric because that's what we use.
We can't help ourselves, right? Yeah, I dropped links to all of those in the show notes so we can so people can get to those directly.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Let's go up a notch, Victor.
Yeah, well, okay. So DSLRs and single lens reflex cameras, these are modeled after the old 35mm cameras that we grew up with. I grew up with the Pentax myself. And this is where you're looking through, a regular eyepiece, but you're seeing what the lens is seeing. You're seeing the depth of field. This is how you get that soft focus in the back and sharp focus, up front, or sharp focus all the way across. It's really going to take you to another level, both in spending of money, definitely, but in also how creative you can be. You can remove the lenses, okay? And that's the big deal here. Therefore, you can use lenses that are very specialized to your needs. Anything from a super wide-angle lens to maybe shoot a dramatic landscape, which you want to do, to huge zoom lenses that people shoot lions and birds and, all without risking your life, and that's what you want to be able to do. Glass is expensive. So the first thing that I want to make sure I emphasize to everybody is that when you're going to take this step, think about your lenses, glass, if you want to be cool. Think about that first.
A lot of glass.
Yeah. I made a mistake in that I pretty much knew that I wanted to dedicate some time and effort into this. And so when I went back into photography, I bought a Nikon D90, fantastic camera, but it uses DX lenses. And that just simply means this, that when you put a 35mm lens in front of that camera, because of the sensor, it crops it out. So it's a good thing because all of a sudden a 35mm lens becomes like 53mm in a regular camera. You basically take whatever the lens is, divide it in half, and then add it. And that's how you know what you're going to get. So a 100mm lens is 150mm in a DX camera. Okay. And that's all very good and highly recommended. But knowing that I eventually, just knowing who I am, was going to step up to a full-frame camera where, one equals one, I bought glass and two or three lenses at expensive prices that were DX. They were made for these crop sensor cameras. And so when I moved up to the Nikon D700, which is a full frame, all that glass wasn't going to work. Mm. I mean, it would work. Literally, I could make it work, but it wasn't giving me a one-to-one ratio. So I had to go and resell. I had to sell all my glass and repurchase glass. So if you think you're really going to dedicate some time and money into DSLR photography, this person's advice is buy the very best glass that you can afford, even if you can only afford one or two lenses. Make sure that the glass is going to work all the way up the line of whatever you're looking at. If you're looking at Nikon, then make sure it's going to work with the D700 or D5X or whatever it is that you're using. And in the very bottom line, get yourself a really super fast 50 millimeter lens. You know about these, right, Allison? Because Bart, right?
We all got into the nifty 50, right? Now, one mistake I made, I'm really happy with my Nikon D40. It is very definitely the bottom of the line of digital SLRs from the Nikon family. Again, it fit my hand, and that was the most important thing to me. But one of the things they did to get the price down was they put the autofocus in the lenses. So right. So you have to have what's called an AFS lens, an autofocus dash S lens. So that it works. Everything's fine with that. But you have to be really careful what you buy. And it also limits your choices. I wasn't able to buy some of the less expensive lenses that would have been, you know, equivalent glass, but I couldn't buy them because they wouldn't work. I'd have to autofocus with my hands, which unfortunately Bart found out the hard way. He bought an AF lens once. And so that was a little bit of a limitation. So I think I would push people up a bit in that. Now, is the D40 one of these DX format things? I don't think it is.
Yes. The D40, the D90 in the Nikon series until you get to the D300 and D300S, those are all what they call crop sensor cameras.
Oh, okay.
Nothing wrong with them, you guys. As a matter of fact, many people think it's a real advantage because you are getting, when you buy a 100 millimeter lens, you are getting 150. You know, you're not having to pay for that glass. It's just only if you think you're ever going to go to a full frame sensor camera that I would say think about what lenses you purchase if you know that that's your end state. If you don't ever believe that you're going to do that, and most people really don't have to, then you're perfectly fine in the Nikon sense buying DX glass. I'm sorry, I don't know what that equivalent is for Canon. I'm not a Canon tuner, although they're great. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with Canon. I just want to make sure I say that right off the bat. Well,
you might be helping me out with a specific problem. My brother went to the Brooks Institute for photography, and he's a spectacular photographer, but he hasn't converted to digital yet. He's a little bit of a Luddite. And he was asking me, you know, we took his lenses and he wanted to know, would they work on my camera? And we put them on and I could hand focus, but it wouldn't autofocus. And that's when I remembered the AFS thing. But I'm wondering whether for someone who is really into photography, whether I should push him towards a non-DX body then.
Yeah, to someone who you're saying has a degree in that and stuff. Well, yeah, he's going to spend more, but he definitely will be able to use. He probably has full frame glass, right? Yeah,
right.
Sure, he does. So yes, you're not going to get the autofocusing, but at that point, you know, those photographers don't care. They're perfectly happily to manual focus. Most people are, and I do that a lot anyways with the 50. Anyways, so yeah, because he'll be able to use or reuse most of that glass anyways. And again, lenses are expensive, you guys, but I believe that if you buy good lenses, then when you want to step up, you can. And so you may spend $500 right off for a full frame sensor, a lens, but it'll work perfectly fine with your DX camera. But if you decide to take that jump, you're not going to have to rebuy glass. I had to do that, and it definitely cost me some money to do it.
Right, right.
You know, and then take your time. You know, you don't have to have every piece of glass. You know, you can get away with murder. Yeah, day one. You know, and more evidence than that is, you know, you can just go out there and look at Bart's photographs. Bart takes incredible photographs. I so wish I was able to do what he does.
And he has a Nikon D40.
Yeah, he has a Nikon D40, and he has good glass. You know, he doesn't have like the top of the line Nikon glass, but what he does with it, that's a perfect example of maximizing what you have. Again, it's not about the equipment. That's just the difference between us wanting to have, you know, XMAC because we can. If we're lucky enough to be able to afford it, great. But that is no reason. It's not going to make you a better photographer, not even one tiny ounce better.
Right, right, right.
You know, just want to make sure that I say that because it has nothing to do with it. The other thing I think in DSLRs is, you know, flash. A lot of the DSLRs will have built-in flash. And you can use that, but it really... it's really not appealing.
It's harsh.
It is so harsh.
But Victor, I spent, you know, I spent the holidays. Everybody says, oh, I hate all this flash is going off. So I tried to do the whole holidays without a flash.
Yeah.
And I just don't have crisp photos.
Right.
They're not sharp.
Were you using a tripod?
No, I'm running around on the floor trying to catch an 18-month-old baby in a photo. Yep. These were not tripod events. These were, you know, just sitting around having dinner or whatever, shooting some photos, you know, secret photos of people, that kind of thing.
Right. And so you have like a 50 millimeter 1.4, right?
Right, right.
Which is a really fast lens, you guys.
Right.
But you run into the same problem that I run into. And for me, I'll tell you, my hand just isn't that steady.
Right. Or the subject isn't that steady or...
Right. And so, you know, you have to be, so the lens is one part of the equation. The other part is what ISO did you shoot those pictures in?
I pushed it up to 1600.
Wow. Okay.
So I mean, they're good, but they're not great. You know, right. They're not that killer shot you wanted.
So for me, I compensate for that, Allison, is that I carry a monopod a lot. Because even that monopod can make the difference between my inability to hold this camera as steady as I'd like and having that sharp picture or not. And sharp pictures are, that is like the one thing that I have seen myself be critical about, is that at first I would let pictures that weren't sharp into my Flickr thing or whatever. And they're still there because I want, but now that is what cuts the grade or not. A picture can be fantastic compositionally and everything, but it is, if not tack sharp, I tend to say, no, I can't show it to anyone.
Yeah, me too.
You know, it is the one thing. So, yeah. So doing the flash thing, if you're going to go with DSLR, having the ability to take your flash off your camera. And these cameras have built-in remotes, you know, that you can trigger an inexpensive flash, you know, but get it off the camera. And just put, you know, even, you know, remember when you were a kid, Allison, and the photographer would always have one hand extended out with a flash?
Yeah.
And then he was taking it?
Right.
Well, that's because he was taking advantage of not wanting that harsh light. And just that simple movement of even moving it off with a cord, you know, which you can plug into your DSLR, and just doing that, if you have to, is better than nothing. The next step, of course, is to just simply buy a $30 cheap flash stand. You know, and yeah, you're going to look like a little bit of a dork, but so what? You're going to get a lot better picture of that baby, you know, or even having Steve hold it. Hey, Steve, hold the flash. Be at a 45-degree angle from me and hold the flash up and down towards the person. And then your...
So these flashes are they're wired to your camera, or no, how do they work?
Well, they can actually work two ways. You can wire them to your camera directly through a cable, an expensive $10 cable, and shoot it that way. But in the Nikon's case, it comes with what's called ITTL. And this system is meant to trigger the camera and to trigger the flash. So Steve can be holding a Nikon flash, and it'll actually wirelessly through, I don't know what magic, it'll trigger the flash wirelessly. You know, through that, you know, that little red sensor in front of your camera?
Sure. Well, I got one of the remotes for Christmas.
Oh.
So I've got the remote, but I'm missing the external flash.
Right. Yeah. So if you get the external flash, I mean, it makes a huge world of difference. And this is an area where I'm really a baby. I haven't not really started to take advantage of, you know, like having a one flash shoot and really knowing what to do with it. One flash, a diffuser, one umbrella. This is like places that I want to go this year and learn about. And Robert Lachman and I were talking that, you know, he needs to show me. He says, but that can make such a huge difference. Even outside, you'd be so surprised at what one flash can do off camera when you're outside in a sunny situation, because you're going to even out that light
so that
the face light now comes out, not just the background. So you'd be surprised that Robert told me they use flashes all the time, even outside. And he carries a little cheapy stand, probably $30, and he'll set that guy up and a little umbrella, and he's ready to go. You know, so it's
and fully dork looking.
Well, yeah. He's getting paid to be dork, so that's okay.
All right. Well, we're running a little bit long here, but we wanted to whip through some. No, I could talk to you for hours. This is a blast. So what about you want to whip through some software applications?
Yeah, we can do that. So a lot of choices today. The first one that I'm going to go with is what you said. Aperture at $80. You guys, that is a deal. I've used Aperture. I've tried it three different times. Every time I went back to Lightroom, because I just know Lightroom so well that it was just a comfort zone for me. But at $80, I bought it the other day, and I'm going to learn how to use it.
Oh, good, yeah. Good.
It is.
Well, Lightroom's $300.
Well, it's $200.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, Lightroom, I think, is $200. But you can get it for $200. So I say right now at this moment in time, that is the way to go. It is excellent software, Bart has some demos out there of what he's done with it. He's put some a typical Shutterbug, and there are tons of free websites that you can go and learn this stuff. If you want to spend a little money, just a little bit, Kelby.com, KelbyTraining.com.
Oh, I love that guy.
Oh, I mean, they do. His entire staff does a great job.
Wait a minute, I thought Kelby only does Lightroom. I don't think he does.
Yes,
he doesn't do Aperture.
Yeah, but I think that they're starting to do some Aperture stuff
are
in
they?
There too. I haven't checked recently.
I hope so. He's hilarious too. That's what I like. He's so easy to read.
Yeah, but it's, and again, Kelby, he's like one of the teachers, but he has teachers in every facet of photography. For $19 a month, I think you can get access to the entire library, and there's gold in them hills. I mean, there's a series on how to shoot in Yellowstone. You know, just nothing, but he's out, you know, Moose Peterson is out there in Yellowstone showing you how he sets up shots and what he's thinking about. And so anyways, those are the kind of places that I learn and I spend way too much time in trying to really get Nietzsche about things. So
I did double check the list price at Adobe's website is $300 for Lightroom.
Oh, okay.
So cool. And Aperture was always $200. It's only this week that it turned down to $80.
Yeah, and I
you got to try it for that.
Well, it's going to be a game changer because it's going to make Adobe have to change. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love
competition.
Competition is what it's all about. So we have that, but you don't even have to go that far. If you go to Adobe Photoshop Elements. Again, I think it's around that $80 price. It's going to do 95% of anything you ever wanted to do in Adobe Photoshop CS4 or CS5. It is fantastic software. You know, again, Lightroom is meant to be, as well as Aperture. You know, I think generally photo librarying is part of it. And they do a really good job for also being able to edit your photos. You know, something like Photoshop Elements is meant to be more of a photo editor and some of the features, especially in layers. This is the difference in that, although I know that Aperture can do some of that stuff, and I've heard that it does it very well. So there's a lot of choice right now, but I think for the money, for your listeners, I think Aperture right now is absolutely the way to go. Maybe because I spent money on it now, I'm really going to give it a try in 2011 and see if I can learn that software. Because
I used to use Photoshop Elements, but since I got Aperture, since it does all of the photo organization and does photo editing, I mean, I just haven't opened Photoshop Elements. In fact, I didn't reload it after my Nuke and Pave.
There you go. Again, if you ever get into layers and stuff, that's where I think Photoshop Elements would start giving you some more bang for your buck. We have a lot of good choices, but you cannot go wrong either with Lightroom or Aperture. I guess at $80, I have to say this week, that's the way to go.
The killer deal.
It is the killer deal.
And then what about where to put your photos after you've taken your masterpieces and you want to show them off?
Yeah, show them off. Don't keep them to yourself. That's what it's about. Picasa is a great choice. Really nice. You know, and it comes and you can get it, you know, for nothing, basically. Mm-hmm. And they do a really great job. If you want to buy it, you know, even a little more storage, they'll give, you know, you can buy it from Google and they give you a great price on it. And they do a really good job of making it really simple to get links and share your photos that way. So you can get that for free. I use Flickr a lot. I have a pro account on Flickr. And Flickr is just the size of the community is so huge. You can, you know, get into photo groups like typical Shutterbug. We have a group there where people share their photos, but they also share ideas and lessons and all of that is available. And then, of course, you can learn a lot in either one of these, but especially Flickr. If you're looking at someone's picture, see if they have the metadata, the stuff that's inside the pictures about when it was taken and what lens, what f-stop. Usually there's a link that says more info. And if you go to that, you can learn all kinds of secrets about how did Bart take that picture. I don't know if Bart publishes metadata or not. I bet he does.
I would think so.
You know, okay. But it will tell you a ton of stuff. I know on my pictures, go look at any of them. It'll tell you exactly what lens I was using, the focal length, the time of day that I took it, was the flash on or wasn't the flash on, what was the ISO. I could go on and on and on. So,
I've really enjoyed some of these sites. You know, when I first started out, I remember I had the free account in Picasa and I was loading up all these albums and then all of a sudden they said, no, you have to pay. And I was like, well, I'm not paying. That's not doing that. It's free. Everything's supposed to be free. But, you know, I think free is kind of over. And you find that the sites that have stuck around and have really done well, like Flickr and Picasa, it's not that much money. I mean, Flickr, the pro account's $25 a year. You know, that's nothing for the ability to put, you know, high res if you want. I don't care about the ownership of my photos because I'm not an artiste. And so I put full the high resolution versions. If somebody wants them, go for it. You know, it's a fabulous community, and you know, $25, that's nothing.
Yeah, I paid for 5 years. I think. I paid for 5 years at one time. I said, I don't want to think about this anymore. I think next year I'm up for renewal, so I'll have to do that again. And then if you want to sell pictures or you want to go to the next level, Smug Mug is definitely the way to go. And I think they have a discount code if you want to use them for a year. If you use Flickr, they give you like $50 off, you know, their original price or something very dramatic.
You know, I've never been happy with the interface on Smug Mug. I just don't enjoy looking at photos when people send me a Smug Mug link. I don't know. As much as I complain about the Flickr interface, I like looking at photos much better in Flickr.
Well, they have a lot of options, and maybe what's happening is that some of the people that are sending to those are not customizing their Smug Mug to how they want you to see them, because you can customize the heck out of Smug Mug as far as exactly what size, what format, what the background is going to be. You can really customize the heck out of that stuff. Smug Mug. I was with them for a year. I dropped them because I thought, you know, I'm not going to be really selling pictures, and Flickr is doing everything I want as long as they don't take it away from us. everything is cool.
That's why it's important to pay the fee, right?
Hey, yeah. You know, one of my friends says, what do you want for nothing? Your money back? You know,
so. Exactly. I love it. Hey, Victor, this has been fascinating. I hope you can come on the show again. This was really, really interesting. And I think everybody should be subscribing to the Typical Shutterbug podcast to get more of you in these conversations with the people you claim know more than you. But I don't know. You're so far ahead of me. It's to hear you, too.
Yeah, they know a ton. And go back to the archives. The very first shows, I mean, just go listen to all of them. Some of the photographers that I have there are like the authority of the, you know, people. I think the first interview I did was with a guy who wrote a book called Understanding Exposure, Brian Peterson. And he is like the authority in this field. And so go back and listen. There's really people that have given so much. So yeah, go subscribe to Typical Shutterbug. Start from show number one and, you know, join me in this potential to be a better photographer, if that's what you want.
That way you get the journey, right?
Yeah, and the journey really was what it's all about. And I would know nothing if it wasn't for, in this case, listening to my own show, because it really, these people have taught me so much.
Fantastic. So people can find you at thetypicalmacuser.com, typicalshutterbug.com, and then follow you on Twitter at Victor Cahiao, if they can spell it, right?
Yep. Figure out how to spell it.
That's like Andy Anako says that, right? You can only email me if you can figure out how to spell my name.
Oh, I didn't know you said that. I say the same thing. Figure it out.
All right, Victor. Thanks so much for the help today, and looking forward to seeing you at Macworld. Pimp your thing you're doing at Macworld.
Oh, okay. My thing that I'm doing at Macworld is going to be a talk, and it's going to be on Thursday from 1 p.m. to 2:15. You do have to be a registered conference user, but yeah, I encourage you to do that. And we're going to be talking all about Spotlight. I'm going to do an hour on Spotlight. If you believe that's possible or not, it is possible. There's gold in them hills, and Spotlight is one of those stepchildren in the OS that I will teach you about, and you will come out wanting to know more.
Very cool. All right. Thanks a lot, Victor. We'll talk to you again soon.
My pleasure.
I had so much fun talking to Victor. I had an eye on the clock. I knew we were running long, but I was so fascinated by learning from him that I couldn't bear to stop it. Every time I talk to Victor, I learn so much. If it's about the Mac, photography, audio, it doesn't matter because he's brilliant in so many things, and he's such a great teacher that he never makes me feel dumb by talking down to me, even though he knows so much more than I do. I'm really happy he took the time to join us this week. Now, I do promise that Bart will be back someday. He will be back on Chit Chat Across the Pond, but until then, I'm really glad that we've had such great, talented people. I would also like to point out that I forgot to do security light this week. So let's see. We got a couple of ideas from the chat room. Mark Shepard said, here's security light. Don't click on attachments. There you go. That's a good one. Let's see. Jim Sewell suggested on security light, if you have a Windows PC, push the big button on the front and don't touch it again. Apparently, he was talking about a power switch. Let's see. Michelle, also known as Country Sign, says, don't go to websites. So that's just going to be our security light for this week. Hope that was good enough. Oh, John also did say that there was a security update for WordPress sometime recently. So go push those little update buttons if you run your own servers. Well, that's going to wind things up for the week. Please keep your emails coming with dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com and follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.